The following is a live presentation of CITR News.
CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast. Now, here are your hosts, Katie Comley and Rita Farkas.
Good evening. Coming up on the program, we've got a little something different to offer you, our News 101 listener. Tonight, we'll be featuring some of the UBC's AMS election candidates.
That's right. Today, we will introduce listeners to some of the students who may be representing them this year. And if you want to review what you've heard here tonight, you can always go to www.citr.ca, click on your podcast link, and listen to the debate again to help you make your decision.
Later in the show, we will have our regular political commentary with Phil Caudry, your weekly arts update, and our weekend weather forecast. But first, we have to remind you of UBC student elections, which are running from now until the 24th of January. You can either vote in person at the sub or online at www.ams.ubc.ca/elections. We have to remind you that online voting is only available from now until Tuesday, January 22nd, not the 24th. Voting in person is available, though, until the 24th, which is a Wednesday. So don't forget to vote.
So for now, we are joined in studio by our candidates. We have some confirmed guests who have not arrived yet, so it may be a small debate. We'll go around the room initially and give 30 seconds or less to the two candidates who are here now. If you could briefly introduce yourselves by saying your name, what position you're running for, some of the key issues of your platform, and a little bit about yourself in general. So go ahead. We'll start with you, Nate.
Hi, my name is Nate Crompton. I'm running for the VP Academic and University Affairs position. I've been involved in council for a year. I was elected as an arts representative, and I've been really involved mostly with the development issues on campus, which is a key part of the VP Academic position. But I started the University Boulevard petition in last spring with some other students from Group Students for a Democratic Society, and the petition ended up turning into a pretty big campus-wide movement, a really positive movement against the privatization of the University Boulevard, a movement against the condo plan for the area, as well as against the shopping mall plan. And that's, I guess, probably how I'm best known on campus. But if you check out my website, it's nathancrompton.com, and it's got a broad platform where the University Boulevard issue is only one of the many issues. The big ones are childcare, UBC Farm, ethical investment policies, and the academic side of the portfolio.
Okay,
so it's nathancrompton.com.
Thanks, Nate. We're going to go to our next candidate who has shown up this afternoon, Stephanie.
Hi, my name is Stephanie Ratchin, and I'm running for the VP external position on the AMS. I guess what I'd like to do with this time on air is just present some of my ideas for the issues that I see are really relevant to the position and students at large. The first one is the idea of accessibility of education. Half of the students at UBC have an average debt of $25,000. This is completely unacceptable. Education is a right, not a privilege, and that's something I firmly believe in. What I want to do, I want to look into a financing system that goes beyond individual student loans. I want to develop a strategy that guarantees student accessibility or addresses the issue up front rather than after the fact. As VPX, I want to look at a program with other universities using education funding strategies from other universities and other countries as well, to develop a profile or report that can be for recommendations that could be implemented into British Columbian tuition strategies. Another priority is TransLink. Some of you might not know, but now TransLink has been privatized. This affects the UPass greatly, and I believe that we really need to ensure that student interests are represented. The UPass needs to stay, the contract should be expanded, and it needs to be affordable. Another thing, another thing that I want to look into is the BC University Act. This is the act that outlines the decision-making structures at UBC, such as like the Senate and the Board of Governors. The thing is with this act is I don't just want to push for better government-appointed representatives. For example, on the Board of Governors, about 11 are appointed by the province, and there's only 3 student representatives. We need better student-directed representation to ensure that student interests are prioritized.
Thanks, Stephanie. That's great. And before we start the debate, which I guess is going to be more like a discussion because of the number of candidates we have here tonight, but that's all right. We just need to lay a few ground rules, which I'm sure will be easy for you guys to follow. All questions that are going to be directed will be towards a specific candidate who will be allowed to respond within a reasonable amount of time, after which the floor will be opened up to the other candidates. Because you have no opponents within your same position, the other VP External and VP Academic, you can comment on each other's questions if you have anything you feel you need to add. We ask that you please respect your opponents and leave them enough time to speak and refrain from name-calling, slander, etc., because this is a family show, but I think we can trust you guys. So our first question goes to Nathan Crompton.
I'm just going to cut him before the first question. I just want to remind the listeners, that it may sound now, with the numbers that we have here, that this is not as much of a debate. But keep in mind that this was designed as a debate. We do have some other confirmed guests who didn't make it this afternoon. So keep in mind that this is actually an open opportunity for all candidates, all some 30 of them, to come out and voice what they'd like to say.
That's very true, Rita. If any of them are listening right now, they feel free to come by the station as long as we can verify that you are a candidate. This is your chance to, we've opened up the floor to you representing UBC's students to make your voice heard. So by all means.
And we will also be continuing a debate on Monday featuring other candidates from other positions. So let's go ahead with the first question.
Okay, great. Nathan, I know you outlined a little bit in your platform overview, but if you could quickly give us some of your thoughts about the situation on University Boulevard and UBC Farm specifically, and what the AMS is doing right now, isn't doing about it that it should.
The Boulevard and the Farm? The two
Yeah,
ones?
Maybe start off with the Boulevard.
Yeah. Well, there was the petition that was in the fall. And it was very clear the way it was written in the petition. It just said that there should be no way for the university to go ahead with building unless there's a full consultation with students. And the wording it says meaningful consultation. What did end up happening was consultations for what's called the above ground portion of the plan, and it's called by the university it's called U Square. And at first it was meant to be shopping and then also condos, but U Square became part of a planning group and students were involved. And the U Square plan was transformed. But ultimately, the university never actually asked students what we wanted with the entire area. And the biggest, one of the most important parts of the plan right now is the $40 million bus loop. And ultimately, nobody has asked students what they think and what we think about the bus loop.
Can you tell us what you know about the plans for the bus loop officially?
Really recently, there was information that was made public, and that was through the office of the that was through the Premier of British Columbia, who said he has plans and he's interested in funding a Millennium Line through TransLink out to the university. So there's a few things. So if anyone ever thought that the bus loop was okay, that was kind of sort of the nail in the coffin for the bus loop idea, just because if the bus loop wants to come out, or sorry, if the TransLink,
yeah.
if TransLink line wants to has to come out, it's going to want to come right to center campus. And this big bus loop is A, it's unmodifiable, and B, it's just too small, and it can't be transformed into a line for the Millennium Line. So it's just going to be a big physical obstacle and a huge $40 million obstacle.
So do you see then the project itself, the bus loop, as being sort of designed to create space for housing and retail space?
Yeah, that was the idea. So the bus loop was the origins of the bus loop were going back to 1999, when the university wanted exactly that, to make room above ground for the condos and the retail. In fact, they had plans for 2 18-story condo towers, which ultimately became completely unpopular. No one liked the 218-story condo towers. So now that, and so what happened was the community scrapped the idea of the condo towers. But for some reason, the university stuck with the idea of the bus loop, even though there's all kinds of room after getting rid of the condo towers for doing all kinds of great things above ground and green space and keeping the Knoll and doing all kinds of things that students like and student social space and other types of things.
So for someone, I mean, I have to say I'm slightly ignorant to, you know, the finer details of the plan, but increased transit to UBC is a generally positive thing. I know there's lots more students commute to UBC than probably live on campus. I don't know the statistics, but is it the physical presence of the bus loop? And you said it's unmodifiable. If there's ever going to be changes to transit in the future, it will always be there as sort of an eyesore, would you say?
No. The key thing to know is that the bus loop doesn't in any way increase transit to campus. I guess that's one of the things. It's
a common
confusing
myth.
For people, because the university has tried to say that the bus loop is part of the sustainability strategy in the TREC 2010 documents and stuff. Mm-hmm. I guess it's just key to know that the numbers show that the TransLink ridership won't increase through the bus loop. And no, it's not necessarily that it's an eyesore. There's a different debate about that, but just the key thing is that there's not very much money for things on campus right now, and it's just problematic that the university is going to be spending $40 million. And the key thing again to know too is that $30 million for the bus loop is coming from the child care fund. It's called the IIC funds, which have traditionally been used for building infrastructure and child care. And those types of things.
Okay.
So $30 million coming from the fund to go to build the bus loop, the very unpopular bus loop.
That's crucial, yeah.
Okay, we need to move on, but I do just want to ask you to comment. Is there anything that, from your opinion, you can see that's positive about the proposal for the bus loop? And just to clarify for listeners who may be confused as to whether or not they support it, what sort of issues do you see that could be positive or are misnomers about it? I mean, you've already mentioned the big one.
Yeah, I think that you mentioned just the visuals, the aesthetics of the bus loop. It could look nice, I'm sure. That could be one of the positives.
Yeah.
And there's certainly all kinds of ways to make the campus look nice.
But,
I just wonder if there are all kinds of other considerations, especially academic concerns, especially if this is a university for students rather than a corporation for turning a profit and getting the developers really wealthy.
Okay, so let's move on. The second issue that we had asked you about was the UBC farm. Maybe address that quickly.
Oh, yeah, okay, the farm. Always the farm is at risk of being bulldozed, especially because it's on South Campus. South Campus is where the real big development has been happening, especially the condo units and the condo development. Right now, under the official community plan, which is the overarching plan that makes regulations for building in South Campus, it says in the OCP, the official community plan, that the farm is what's called a future housing reserve. So it's so-called non-institutional, which means that the university can build it, can use it to build non-academic market things, specifically condos, but also retail. So the key thing that I'm going to make sure that I do with Graduate Student Society is make sure that the farm gets listed in the official campus plan as what's called institutional or future academic reserve.
Buildings that can't be touched.
Buildings that can't or not as easily touched by developers, and that would sort of secure the future of the farm.
Okay. Rita, do you have anything to add to that?
No, thanks for your response. There will be an opportunity for you to bring up any other issues. We're going to quickly cut to a PSA break, and we will be back to hear from our second candidate, Stephanie Ratchin.
If you're interested in a wicked mix of performances all taking place in one night and locally at one place, then
it's the fourth annual fundraiser for the North Shore Women's Center.
We're talking about an all-women's mixed program, a rare artistic collaboration of acclaimed local performers that have come together for a common cause.
Happening Saturday, February 2nd, 2008 at the Centennial Theatre located at 2300 Lonsdale Avenue in North Vancouver.
Tickets available after January 24th, either in person or by phone at the North Shore Women's Center, the Centennial Theatre Box Office, or Little Sisters. Reach us by phone at 604-984-6009.
Performances include dancing, theatre, improv, and more. Early bird tickets available.
All you people care about is readers and making money off of her. She's a human! Leave Brittany alone!
If you don't want to miss your favorite CITR show because it makes fun of the spiel, then you've got nothing to worry about. Now you can get all of the CITR 101.9 FM radio shows off our website and download them straight onto your computer or MP3 players. Just visit www.citr.ca/podcast and dive into a pool of all of the past radio shows, such as...
Because all you people want is more, 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 more! Leave her alone!
All to your little heart's desire.
Sweet, sweet, sweet.
Party! C-I-T-R.
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 Party! Yeah!
Keep tuning in for more information.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
This is News 101, and the current time is 5:21, and we're continuing with the AMS candidates debate here on CITR 101.9 FM, and we're moving on to our second candidate that is here with us tonight. It's Stephanie Ratchin, and she's running for the position of VP External. And Stephanie, if you just want to bring up, you had one issue regarding international student fees that you wanted addressed as an important part of your campaign platform. So if you just want to intro that...
Sure. The international student question is one that's been addressed to me at both debates that have gone on so far. And the question has been sort of what to do about international student rates. The Canadian dollar is rising. A lot of people have come to Canada to have an education, which they feel is a very good one. One of the things that came up last night, or one of my platform ideas, is that I believe that education is a right. It should never be a privilege to have an education. And what was addressed last night was that an international student asked me whether that applies to international students at UBC as well. Yeah, I definitely believe that we need to reduce the barriers to education. There have been some tax considerations coming up in regards to how education is financed in British Columbia. But I believe that international students play a really valuable role in the university environment. UBC marks itself as being or establishing a program of global citizenship. We need to have international students. We need to have a program that makes international students a valuable part of our university.
Stephanie, can I ask, when you say that you believe that education is a right, not a privilege, I wonder how you would respond to somebody who questions that ideal because it means ultimately an influx in students and maybe the watering down of the education system or more competition within a school. How would you respond to the concept? I know this was an idea that was brought up after the tuition freeze was raised years ago, that in fact it's helpful somewhat for students to have limits on how many students can be accepted into university, whether it be financially or because of grade point averages. So what would you respond to that?
I think a lot of people have been challenging me on that belief, and I definitely stand by it. There's been a couple of the challenges have come from the idea of financing for education. The thing is that finances are usually the biggest barrier to achieving a post-secondary education for a lot of people. This should not be the case. We need to have an education system that affords the opportunity to learn for a lot of people, regardless of their financial background. I mean, I know that there's a statistic out there saying that the number one factor in determining how much you will earn over a lifetime is sort of the social class in which you were born. There's a severe class rigidity in our society, and we really need to work towards an educational program that that addresses that and acknowledges that and makes sure that those people who want to, who can and are, yeah, who want to have an education are able to.
Okay, thanks for that response. So one more question that Rita just kind of brought up that would be a very pertinent thing to do would be outline some of the responsibilities or duties of VP External, because just judging by the name, it's not really apparent to people what your duties actually are. So for, you know, the just average UBC student who's going, looking at your name, wondering what you are going to contribute to the AMS, if you could just explain that.
Yeah, definitely. The VP External, I guess the official job description for that would be to improve student life on campus through liaison with all external organizations. So what that means is the VP External in the AMS at UBC deals with other organizations like TransLink and deals with the UPass. It also deals with the municipal, provincial, and federal governments on behalf of the university. The third most important job description piece is dealing with national student unions. UBC is a part of CASA right now, so maintaining and establishing a strong voice and a strong membership.
Status. Sorry, can you just clarify for anybody that doesn't know what is CASA?
CASA
just briefly?
Is the Canadian Alliance of Student Associations, and is the national student union to which UBC belongs to.
Okay. Okay, one more question. This is something that I think the majority of UBC students and faculty, for that matter, are concerned about. Why is or isn't it important to protect the UPass? And how is the AMS going to play a role in whether or not we protect it?
Like I mentioned earlier, the UPass is one of the priorities that the VP External deals with. A lot of people may not know, or maybe do know, that TransLink has gone some governance restructuring in the last few months. How that works is now that there are two boards. There's an appointed board of directors, and then there's a council of mayors. The council of mayors receives about one vote per 20,000 persons in regards to transit plan options for BC and Vancouver. Why it affects UBC in particular is because UBC does not have a mayor. It does, or even the University Endowment Lands. We're sort of on our own in that respect. Why that's problematic is because we don't have any representation in this decision-making body. So if any student has any issues that they want to bring up to the board of directors, they've got nowhere to turn. This is new, and this is highly problematic, particularly for things like the UPass. The UPass, I believe, has been an amazing program for multiple different reasons. A lot of people use it. It is a very reasonable monthly pass. One thing we really need to look at is that it needs to stay in effect, particularly with the privatization of TransLink and also with the recent developments that they have announced. We need to ensure that the UPass stays affordable.
That's great. I think, do we want to wrap
Let's go up? To let's go to a quick PSA break, and then we're going to give these guys a last chance to maybe plug any serious issues they'd like to talk about.
Recoup and recollect their thoughts.
We'll be right back. News 101 will continue.
CITR podcast update. Number 5.
Work has begun on Canada's information highway. That's the state-of-the-art network that we're told will change everything from the way we do business to the way we learn. As it comes more and more into our personal lives, how are we going to cope with the techno-peasants? I mean, this world, which was a fantasy for me 10 years ago, every 6 months becomes more a part of my own real life. You know, in the place where I do most of my writing, I now I'm just hooked into the world electronically,
right,
or
yeah.
would be if I could figure out how to make the bleep bleep modem work. But I'm technologically over my head already. The limit on me is not what you can do, it's what I can do.
I'm not sure you want to use your bleep bleep modem, or any modem for that matter, with receiving podcasts. But, just check out our website and I'm sure you'll figure it out.
For more information, visit citr.ca/podcast. Thank you for listening, and please be kind to robots.
February 20th, tune in all night long for the Homelessness Marathon on CITR.
Why do a nationwide homelessness marathon?
Because homeless people should have access to the media where they can freely speak out. Because it is the homeless who are best able to educate people on the issue of homelessness.
This 14-hour broadcast will begin at sunset on Wednesday, February 20th, and continue through sunrise the next day in front of the Native Friendship Center of Montreal.
This year, more than 30 stations are carrying the Homelessness Marathon. For more info, visit www.citr.ca.
To participate, dial 1-866-763-4136. Call toll-free.
Did you say you don't want people giving you too much?
No, well, you don't want to see, like, when you panhandle, people like you to come off with some clever kind of saying. And it's really unique, because every individual's got what's going to make them laugh, and you may not even understand why they're laughing.
It's 5:30, and we're wrapping up our live student election debate here on News 101 on CITR. And before we go, or before we end our discussion with our candidates, we'd like to give each of them an opportunity to provide us with some final comments about themselves and their platform and what you should know about the AMS elections. So keep in mind, this isn't an open debate, but just a final round of comments, and this is your last chance to speak. So we'll start with Nathan Crompton.
Yeah, my name is Nathan Crompton. You can check out my website. It's nathancrompton.com. Today I'm going to have a really cool link to a radio program, and you can listen to it. So I hope you'll go to the website and check out the platform section, especially, which talks about some of the key issues in the election, especially the child care issue and the investment, the UBC farm, and the academic issues that are key to the VP academic portfolio. I hope to make sure that I can answer questions if people want to know about the platform or add to it or take something out of it do things like that. My website is, again, nathancrompton.com, and I really hope that people vote, especially in the other races too. There's some very good candidates, some progressive candidates who are interested in actually sort of, well, taking back the campus and bringing democracy to the university at many different levels, which is crucially important, especially now that the university is turning more and more into a privatized, commercialized extension of the British Columbian economy. So I hope you'll vote, and I hope you'll check out my website, nathancrompton.com.
Thanks very much, Nathan. And we're moving back on to Stephanie. What do you have to say?
Hi. I guess I'll do a plug for my website as well. It's www.stefvpx.com. There's a lot more comprehensive information about some of the stuff I'm raising here. Before we close on the session, I guess what I want to talk about is the idea of building solidarity amongst BC universities. A lot of people get kind of freaked out when I say the word solidarity, and especially because it's something that the CFS, or the Canadian Federation of Students, which is sort of the opposing National Student Union to CASA, uses. What I want to do with the VP external position is actually build up a coalition of BC universities to lobby our provincial government, because this is the level of government that affects the most, that affects decisions the most at in regards to how the university is run and how it is funded. We really need to work together on this, regardless of our National Student Union, and this is something I'm strongly advocating for. For more information on my ideas, please go to www.stefvpx.com, and please vote as well.
Okay, so thank you so much to Steph and Nate for coming out this afternoon. We'd like to reiterate that we did have some other candidates who are scheduled to be here who didn't show up. So we really appreciate the appearance of these two candidates. And yeah, we want to emphasize to all students how important it is to go out there and vote.
We should reiterate the election information once again, where you can vote. It's at you can vote in person at the Student Union Building, and we all know where that is on campus, or you can vote online at www. www.ams.ubc.ca/elections. You can find out more about the candidates on that website as well, besides their personal websites. And we just really encourage you to, yeah, exercise your democratic right and get out and vote. It's your university, and it's your chance to make your voice heard.
Okay, so that's it for this edition of The Debate. Stay tuned for Monday's show. We will have some more candidates coming out. Next, we're going to go on to our regular segment, Political Commentary with Phil Caudry. This week, Phil takes a look at recent $14 billion public transportation announcement made by the provincial government. He looks at what benefits it could bring and what potential political problems could arise for Gordon Campbell and his BC Liberal Party.
Premier Gordon Campbell and Transportation Minister Kevin Falcon announced a $14 billion transportation package for the Lower Mainland. This unprecedented package, being the largest public transportation announcement in British Columbian history, has a goal of doubling commuters on a daily basis throughout the Lower Mainland. The goal is intended to reduce congestion and traffic on the roads and to reduce the environmental impact by the Lower Mainland. Of the $14 billion, British Columbia is planning to put in $4.75 billion and wants $3.1 billion from Ottawa. The Regional Transit Authority is on the hook for $2.75 billion, and local governments are expected to pony up $500 million for the projects. Some of the transportation projects in the transportation package include a SkyTrain route to UBC. However, unlike the Millennium and Expo Line, this would be an underground subway-style SkyTrain. The introduction of the Evergreen Line, a streetcar-style system from Burnaby, Port Moody to Coquitlam, is also part of the package. The RAV Line, which is currently being constructed from the airport to Vancouver, is also included in the package. On paper, this looks like a great opportunity for British Columbia. BC is in desperate need of some new transportation infrastructure and also needs to get more public commuters on the road as a means to reduce our environmental impact. The best way to do that is infrastructure. However, there's some potential problems. One must realize that the funding isn't there yet. This is simply an announcement, a political maneuver for Gordon Campbell to leverage public funding from the federal government and local communities. It's also something he's going to campaign with for his re-election bid next year. The funding that British Columbia wants from the federal government of $3.1 billion is not guaranteed yet. It's simply something in principle that they want from the federal government. The $500 million requested from local governments to Lower Mainland have also not been approved. However, there's some room for a guarded optimism. Public Safety Minister Stockwell Day, who is also the regional minister for British Columbia, says that the feds have the funds to provide for this project. He cites $2.2 billion that they have for over 7 years for British Columbian transportation. He also says that the federal government has put in $450 million for the RAV line, which is already being constructed and is part of the package. In contrast to Day's sunny optimism, Surrey Mayor Diane Watt says that her city can simply not provide the funding necessary to get this project off the ground. She says that in order for her city to provide the necessary funds, that they would have to raise property taxes, which she says is simply just not an option. As local governments in the Lower Mainland are usually strapped for cash, her plea doesn't seem like a political play, and moreover seems like a genuine concern. Also, Gordon Campbell states that no carbon tax or tax hikes will be used to pay for this infrastructure. This could be a concern if the BC Liberal government is unable to receive the funding it needs for this project. However, if the BC Liberal government does not receive the necessary funds it requires to fund the program, it could find itself in a precarious position. Gordon Campbell may have to choose to add carbon taxes to pay for the project, or general tax hikes may need to be implemented. For someone who's running as pro-business and anti-tax, this would not be a good move. So if I were to give Gordon Campbell one piece of advice, it would be to have a plan B. Make sure you know which programs you're going to transfer funds from or what kind of wasteful spending you're going to cut if the funds don't come through. The last thing you want to do is look like you're flip-flopping on an issue that is very contentious in British Columbia. Transportation is an issue you can lose a re-election campaign on. And if you don't have a plan B when the funding doesn't come through, you could find yourself out of office. For News 101 Commentary, I'm Phil Caudry.
And thanks, Phil, as always, for that piece. Now we're going to turn to our weekly arts report, and we're going to start off with a review from our very own News 101 producer, Megan Turcotto, and she went and saw a play recently. Correct me if I'm wrong, Megan, you can intro.
Yes, I did. In fact, it was called The Misfit, and this week the PUSH International Festival is presenting The Misfit, which is both written and performed by Anita Majumdar, a local of Port Moody. It's set in India, and The Misfit follows a troupe of classical Indian dancers who earn their living performing at weddings. The play explores the questions of what is right and wrong and what it means to be a good girl in the context of a culture in which dishonor can often mean violence, particularly against women who must carry the weight of their family's honor and pay the price for any perceived indiscretion. These questions are played out through the members of the dance company. There's Nan, the Indo-Canadian choreographer, disillusioned by the path her life has taken. Nan sees Indian weddings as a sad occasion, the end of the bride's freedom. She channels the alternative perspective of the elegant Indian wedding. Using her sharp wit, she lampoons the wedding tradition, exposing the tragedy among the pageantry. Nan is joined by the wealthy divorcee, Nikki, whose marital breakup is considered the ultimate disgrace. Then there is orphan Susu, who apparently married a mango tree, which at first seems riotously funny because of the sheer absurdity of such a statement. Yet as the play continues, it becomes apparent that no one is joking. This girl was actually forced by her community to marry a mango tree. Here the laughter was replaced with a surprised silence. Finally, the dance mistress, who believes that social honor must be rigidly maintained. But just how far will she go to preserve it? As the layers of their histories are peeled back, the audience learns that each has been involved in social violence. It is left to your perspective who is innocent and who is guilty, and who is truly acting honorably. The dialogue is interspersed with short dance pieces, which blend classical dance with music video moves, all done to the raunchy rhythms of North American hip-hop. The dance sequences only served to highlight the inherent hypocrisy of the Indian honor system. The audience is privy to the ironic nature of these wedding dances, making them quite comical while at the same time entrancing. Anita Majumdar portrays all the characters, sensitively embodying diverse perspectives with humor and integrity. The result is a play which is both funny and thought-provoking. The Misfit is playing at Performance Work on Granville Island, but only till January 19th, so get out there and check it out.
Okay, thank you, Megan. So in continuation of our arts report, we're going to go now to our arts reporter, Katie Fitzpatrick, for a look at this week's listings.
Hello and welcome to your 5-Minute Arts Beat. I'm Katie Fitzpatrick for News 101. Of course, the big news this week is the International Performing Arts Festival, the PUSH Festival, which is happening January 16th to February 3rd. It kicked off Wednesday night, and I was there at the Black Rider, the casting of the Magic Bullets for the big kickoff, the opening night of that show as well. We had the executive director of the PUSH Festival and the artistic director of the Arts Club Theatre talking to us about what this festival means. It's a festival that happens in Vancouver every year, right around the new year. It features theatre, dance, music, and tons of events that are just across the board, hard to pin down, a little bit of all of the above. And that was certainly the case with The Black Rider. Although it was a theater production, dance and music also played a large part in the production. We're going to have a full review of that show, actually, on Tuesday's Arts Express, where we're also going to be interviewing the lead actor and the artistic director of November Theater, Michael Scholar Jr. Now, of course, that's not the only event going on to do with the PUSH Festival. There's tons of interesting things. One is Frankenstein. Catalyst Theater presents an adaptation of Mary Shelley's classic Gothic novel. That's at the Vancouver East Cultural Center until January 26th. Another theater event that's going on as part of the PUSH Festival is Old Goryeo, which is presented in collaboration with Western Gold Theater and Theater at UBC. It's James Fagan Tate's adaptation of Honoré de Balzac's masterpiece about the twin obsessions of money and love. Now, that is also till January 26th, at the Chan Center for the Performing Arts here at UBC. Also going on with the PUSH Festival, there's The Misfit, there's The Four Horsemen, and later in the festival, coming up in the end of January, there's a lot of dance and other types of events, and even on Sunday night, there's something quite interesting, 46 circus acts in 45 minutes. That's on at 2 and 4 o'clock on Sunday, and you can find all this information at www.pushfestival.ca, where they have descriptions of all their shows, as well as a breakdown schedule. Now, of course, PUSH Festival isn't all that's going on in theatre and in the art scene in Vancouver. This week, there's a few other productions coming up as well. One is The Banana Boys, Leon Orius's play based on Terry Wu's novel about five regular Asian-Canadian guys in their mid-20s struggling with issues of identity and self-worth. That's till February 9th at the Viral Arts Center. Also on currently is Dish Pig. Greg Landucci plays 15 roles in TJ Dawes' behind-the-scenes look at the life of a restaurant dishwasher. That's at the Havana, a 1212 commercial, a great restaurant, art gallery, and theater, and it's on till January 19th. Also on currently is The Blonde, The Brunette, and The Vengeful Redhead. Lucy Peacock portrays seven different characters in a one-woman show production about the shattered life of a suburban housewife. That is till February 2nd at the Vancouver Playhouse. Of course, there are also multiple events going on around music. One is the Mozart Cycle. James Ennis performs Mozart's Violin Concertos. That's at the Chan Center for the Performing Arts, again here on campus, January 18th to 19th at 8 p.m., so that's tonight and tomorrow night. Another event going on in music is Spotlight, the VSO at the Roundhouse. Pianist-conductor Brian Maltowey performs the North American premiere of his own Pictures in the Smoke, plus works by Omar Daniel, Brian Cherney, and Harold Meltzer. Toby is joined by Beth Orson on English horn, Julia Lockhart on bassoon, and Sophie Densereau on bassoon. That is tonight at 8 p.m. at the Roundhouse Community Arts and Recreation Center. Another music event going on shortly is the Cecilia Ensemble Women's Choir. Lars Cario conducts a performance at Pergolesi's Shabbat Matter, featuring guest soprano Catherine Crouch and organist Dennis Bedard. It's a benefit for Covenant House Vancouver, which assists homeless youth. It's tonight, also at 8 p.m., at the Holy Rosary Cathedral. On to dance, there's lots of